From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live in Fremont.
I live in Russian Valley in the Richmond District.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
Coming up, lending a sympathetic ear in times of need.
You don't really need to have a mental health issue to call the warm line. If you're stressed out and you need someone to talk to, that's enough for us to be here.
Then we hear the stories of survivors of the San Francisco AIDS epidemic.
Despite all of these challenges they've had, they still have this kind of beautiful attitude to kind of keep going forward.
And an aerial dance program in Southeast San Francisco takes the weight off kids' shoulders.
Why can't we make pictures that shape the space in a more dimensional way?
Coping, surviving, and flying. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. 70,000 people call San Francisco's suicide crisis line each year. If someone's making that call, it usually means they're on the verge of harming themselves and in severe emotional distress. But San Francisco has a service that's aimed at reaching people before they're on the brink of crisis. In this piece, which first aired last year, KALW's Audrey Dilling introduces us to the Warm Line.
So here's a scenario you might relate to. Let's say it's late at night, you've got a big presentation at work tomorrow, and you're not prepared. You've just had too much going on in your personal life, and now you're freaking out. You can't sleep. It would really help to talk to someone, but no one's around. Well, there's actually a number you can call in situations like these. And if you dial it, you might hear this on the other end.
Thank you for calling the San Francisco Health Peer Warm Line. This is Daisy.
Daisy Mathias is one of the counselors at San Francisco's Warm Line, a peer-run support line for people who need someone to talk to.
Then it's your turn. Like, you could tell us what you want. You could just open up. In fact, if you need to bawl out, just cry. Or you could say, I'm stressed, I'm lonely.
Being a peer counselor means Mathias has dealt with a lot of the same issues that people are calling her about. She's not a certified therapist by any means, but she has other qualifications.
For example, I'm a person who has been diagnosed with a learning disability, a person who has social anxiety, and I don't know what else.
You don't have to be diagnosed with anything to call, and you don't have to be in crisis. That's one big difference between the Warm Line and suicide hotlines.
You don't really need to have a mental health issue to call the Warm Line. If you're stressed out and you need someone to talk to, that's enough for us to be here.
What it does is that it provides a space for people to talk about things before they reach a level where it would be considered a mental health concern.
Melody Jarvis has managed the Warm Line since it launched less than a year ago. It started with funding from a state grant. The goal was to reduce hospitalizations for mental health issues and improve access to support services. Warm Line counselors are trained to refer callers to affordable therapy options.
And I remember our very first day, I was training all the new counselors who were here, and we only received one call our first day. But then very quickly, we started receiving more and more calls. And then now, we receive up to, 70, 80 calls per day.
It turns out, a lot of those calls are coming from outside the Bay Area. And the Warm Line's online chat service is actually being used by people around the world. This wide reach says something to Melody Jarvis.
I think it's a sign that this is a very necessary service that's needed in every county and every state.
Jarvis says part of the Warm Line's appeal is this peer support thing. In a more traditional situation, a therapist or whoever answers a crisis line doesn't usually reveal anything personal. But Jarvis has found that hearing from someone who's been there before does a lot for Warm Line callers.
The great thing about our line is we don't necessarily have to sound like that, what seems to be the problem? It sometimes can feel like you're talking to a friend.
Warm Line counselor Daisy Mathias says that feeling is something she could have used when she was struggling with her own mental health, starting back in high school.
I come from a very, I'll just say this, very traditional Catholic family from Mexico, and I'm a very liberal, pagan, feminist, And, oh, on top of that, I was also that weird goth girl in school.
Is your hair always that color? Or?
Well, for people on the radio, if you can't see, my hair color is a yellow and then goes orange, red, dark red, and then purple.
So pretty early on, Matthias started looking outside her home for someone to talk to.
Well, I didn't grow up with the most wealthy family, so I didn't really have very good internet access at the time. So I mostly used the 411, but they mostly transferred me to crisis lines. But there were moments where a crisis line would not be the one to help me because I needed to talk and vent. But since they're trained to handle people who are in crisis who will hurt themselves, I didn't feel I could go to them immediately.
Now, as a warm line peer counselor, Matthias gets to have that conversation she needed all the time. She's just on the other end.
For me, I actually enjoy some of the conversations we have. I can't really list any examples.
There's stories that don't get talked about out in the open very much, but there are lines open for them, for as long as people need to vent or just feel heard. Once that happens, Matthias says the call usually ends like this.
I'm done venting. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Right now, like the handful of other warm lines around the country, the San Francisco warm line operates on limited hours. But manager Melody Jarvis says the plan is to go 24/7 as soon as possible. For Cross Currents, I'm Audrey Dilling.
The phone number for San Francisco's Peer Run Warm Line is 1-855-845-7415. Since we first aired that story last May, Dilhara Abegunesekara has replaced Melody Jarvis as Warm Line Program Manager. The Warm Line is still running on limited hours and is launching a crowdfunding campaign this week to help them move to 24-hour service. Find details about that and current counseling hours at KELW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Talking to peers can be a vital tool for making it through dark times. But what happens when your friends and loved ones aren't around anymore? That's the situation for many older gay men in San Francisco, whose community was decimated by the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s and 90s. 30 years ago, getting diagnosed was almost always a death sentence. Nobody understood the disease, and treatments were at least a decade away. Nowadays, HIV is more of a chronic condition, one that can be managed with drugs and medical care. In San Francisco, the majority of people infected are over the age of 50 and have been living with the disease for many years. Those long-term survivors got the attention of San Francisco Chronicle health reporter Aaron Alde.
What really brought it to my attention as an issue was actually the suicide of Jonathan Klein, who was a long-term survivor. He'd been infected with HIV since the 80s. And I didn't know Jonathan Klein. I'd never heard of him before, but I heard about his suicide, and it just struck me as incredibly sad and tragic that somebody who had outlived this epidemic, who had come out on the other side, would end his life.
Alde's reporting project, Last Men Standing, turned into a multimedia story and a feature-length documentary film. I talked to Aaron Alde and filmmakers Tim Husson and Aaron Breathauer about the project. What kind of themes were you getting from talking to these people, these many, many, many people? At the end, you whittled them down to kind of eight. What were you hearing? What were some of the common threads?
Well, Tim and I joined, well, we were paired together to start working on the video and film last June. And we started working with these eight men. And some of the themes that were coming through, I think, immediately were, you know, they're really struggling with isolation and loneliness. And also, you know, there's a host of health problems they've been struggling with, but there's also this, like, mental health component of how do you recover when you think you had this death sentence way back when, you've survived, and how do you kind of go on living?
The stories definitely vary, but there are a lot of common themes that are expressed in both the film and the written piece about, like Aaron said, isolation and loneliness, trying to find a connection to the world around them.
And they're about 60 years old, 50, 60?
50 to 70. Mm-hmm.
50 like, to 70.
I think the youngest was 56.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
And the oldest is now 71. So some of them have partners, a lot of them don't. I mean, they've seen a lot of their close friends and community die, so it's been hard for a lot of people to build that up again, and some have been more successful than others, but it is definitely kind of like one of the biggest themes, and I think they'll tell you that too.
Aaron Alde, can you tell me one story that is striking to you?
Wow, I don't know if there's any any one story. I mean, I guess I'll start with maybe Ganymede, who was one of the first men that I spoke with for the story. And I was surprised because he was one of the first people I talked to, and his story just immediately grabbed me, which is just this idea that he'd lost, one lover in the middle of the worst years of the AIDS epidemic. I think he died in the peak year, in fact, in 92 or 93. Ganymede pulled back from that. He recovered. He kind of was ready to press on and move on. And then he, met another man and he fell in love. And it's, the early 2000s. And at that point, we had drugs to treat AIDS. People were living. This was already becoming more of a chronic condition than a death sentence. And that was after sort of the tide had turned and AIDS was a totally different, the epidemic was a different character. Mm-hmm. And here's Ganymede with his new lover Steven, and they have this happy life and they feel like they have survived alone together, and then Steven gets sick and Steven dies.
Okay, so let's take a listen to Ganymede in the film.
For many years we forgot that we were dying. We were pillars standing amidst the ruins, because our community had already been devastated. From 88 to 95, easily 60, 80 people I knew had died. We lost a whole generation of men, noble men, intelligent men, wise men, amazing human beings. Think how much further along our whole civilization would be if we still had those men among us today. My heart was broken so many times that there came a point when I just didn't want to go through that anymore.
That was the voice of Ganymede, one of the people featured in Last Men Standing. With me are the team behind the project and the film, Aaron Brethauer, Tim Husson, and Aaron Alde. We hear about survivor's guilt. Was that prominent in what you were hearing?
I have to say, I don't know if you guys feel this way, that was not something that came up really that much. I asked everybody about that, and a lot of the guys said no, and I think that it was something that had crossed their minds, and certainly it was something that a lot of them had felt at various times over the years, but it wasn't something that seemed to be a common struggle or a persistent struggle. And I think a lot of that is because a lot of these guys said, quite frankly, that survival was really tough. They were really, really struggling, and as grateful as every one of them was to still be here and to have survived, they were in tough spots. And I mean, Peter Green talked a lot about that, about being, the unluckiest lucky person alive. And that really captures that kind of idea that, yeah, of course he's lucky and he's grateful to still be here, or he passed away. But he was not lucky to still be dealing with, all of the fallout.
Did you make personal relationships or like a personal
contacts with anybody? Anybody special?
Yeah, I think when someone shares their life story with you, you know,
there's a connection.
Yeah, who puts their heart out and tells you everything that's happened, there is, like, you do develop a really deep connection with them.
I mean, we probably cried with every one of these guys at various times, and yeah, definitely got to be very close with all of them, you know, to varying degrees. But and you know, a couple of them, good friends with. I got to be very close with Peter Green, and in fact, a week before he died, I had gone to dinner with him and an old friend of his. That was just a friendly dinner. He just had kind of wanted, and he wanted to take us out. It was a big deal to him to be able to take us out, which ordinarily as a reporter, I would never, you know, let somebody, a source, you know, pay for a meal. But I could sense that that was something that he wanted to do for whatever reason. It was important to him to, he didn't have a lot of money, and he just, he wanted to treat us. And so I allowed it, and we went to some cheesy fondue restaurant and just had a blast. I mean, just stayed there for a couple hours, just laughing and laughing. And so I did. I had developed a very, you know, strong connection with him. And it was, when he died, it was very hard. And I, you know, I felt sad for that in a way that was more than just, you know, sad that somebody had died. But it, I felt like I'd lost a friend.
And we might go out with a Peter Green clip then.
Yeah,
this is Peter Green. Let's end by hearing from Peter Green.
Watching my friends die, I realized I'm not immortal. This is going to happen to me. And so that was the beginning of trying to survive. I was going to put my body on the line and hope for the best. What really makes a difference when you look back on your life are those simple human connections. Look people in the eye and tell them what you feel. And AIDS taught me that. I've fought the tide of this, and the chips fall where they may. I'm lucky to have come this far. Just don't ever think that it's over until it is.
That was the voice of Peter Green, one of the men featured in the reporting project and documentary film Last Men Standing, about long-term survivors of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco. The film premieres tomorrow night at the Castro. For more information, go to KALW.org, click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hainaut Baba. San Francisco is full of survivors, people escaping from strife and creating spaces to heal it. Hardship sometimes leads to the most beautiful expressions of resilience. In San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point, an Iranian expat has been teaching neighborhood kids to fly. KALW's Todd Whitney takes us there.
There's a warehouse out in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood, on Yosemite Street, just off of 3rd, Zaco Dance Theater. Inside, there's a group of young people, 6 to 18 years old, and they're climbing on pieces of welded iron that hang 3 feet off of the ground. Up there, they're spinning, floating, and thriving.
I always think about this as like a place where people dream, and it has such a special energy. My name is Joanna, and I've been dancing. I've been dancing for 110 years.
That's Joanna Highgood. She's the creative director and founder of Zaco. And it's really more like 50 years that she's been dancing. She's a slim woman with a full-faced and frequent smile. And right now, she's sitting down with a group of kids, dancers in Zaco's youth company. They've just finished a rehearsal, and now they're sharing poems and decompressing. It's something Joanna makes sure her students do a lot. When she was 5 years old, an earthquake hit her home in Tehran, Iran. It was devastating. Joanna's father took her along as he went about town looking to help others.
At one point, we came to this small village, and there was a circle of people in the distance, and there was this really beautiful music playing, and I just wandered over there, and to my surprise, there was this gorgeous young girl, probably around 10 or 12, dancing in the center, and I was transfixed by her. I mean, I could not stop watching. It was like drinking the most extraordinary elixir. I was completely drunk with the image and the vision of this extraordinary young girl. And when I saw her, I thought to myself, that is what I want to do. That's what I want to find. That's what I want to experience.
A few years passed and Joanna's family moved to England. One of the family's new neighbors was a dancer with Barnum and Bailey Circus, a woman named Judith Holmes. She introduced Joanna to aerial expression in the form of the Flying Walindas. She would sit mesmerized, watching people walk tightropes high in the air. Those performances sparked something in her. Choreography didn't have to be confined to the stage or to the floor. So it got her thinking.
Hey, why are we on the ground? Why are we stuck on the ground? Why can't we make pictures that shape this, you know, the space in a more dimensional way? And that became the impetus for pretty much the rest of my career.
Joanna grew up and she moved to the United States. She started Zaco in 1980 and the organization moved to Bayview in 1989. Shipyard jobs were disappearing. The city's black population was falling. Black nationalism was in full effect in the neighborhood.
For a long time, it was really difficult to get support because people would say things like, black children need to be studying, you know, African dance. And I don't see the relevance of teaching them aerial work.
But Joanna thought differently.
I still remember my first day with the youth company. I did not even have the courage to climb on the apparatus.
That's Azra Muhammad. She's 18 and she's been dancing at Zaco for 10 years.
To this day, I'm still afraid of heights, but Zaco gave me the confidence to be able to express myself.
Probably the most proudest moment was when it was actually her first year, actually her first maybe month or two at Zaco.
And that's her mom, Catherine Muhammad.
Knowing, that she's afraid of heights and she had to overcome certain things. And when I watched her dance, it was just amazing because it didn't even look like the same person. It was like a transformation.
It's almost as if they grow several inches. You know, in all, you know, their arms get longer and they get taller.
Again, Joanna Highgood.
And they get more excited about, you know, being in their bodies.
Zaco's teaching goes beyond the physical. There's also a mission to have young people take ownership over their ideas. As part of the curriculum, they read up on things like history, architecture, and social happenings.
I used to be very scared to talk.
Again, Azra Muhammad.
Just talk to anybody, really, but now I'm pretty comfortable through Joanna making us express ourselves not only on the apparatus, but also before while we're building. There's a lot of communication that goes on, so it has made me a better communicator as well.
Each year, the students focus on a different theme. In the past, they focused on the environment and police brutality. Right now, they're investigating identity, and they're defining themselves through poetry.
Who am I? Some days, I don't know. I mean, I'm always expected to answer with, I am Azra Muhammad, but what does that really mean? So far, all I got is, I am Azra Muhammad, a Muslim, daughter, friend, sister, dancer, and artist.
It's this investigation of self and possibility that Joanna Highgood is looking to provoke, to use dance, and the body to instill the imagination with the ability to go beyond the mundane. Zaco is a space to flex the mind and the body, a place where personalities and imaginations, they don't have to stay on the ground. They can fly. In San Francisco, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
That story was produced for last year's Sights and Sounds of Bayview, a multimedia radio and live performance event. This year, Sights and Sounds is coming to East Oakland. The performance is April 17th. Head to KALW.org for all the details. And if you miss us on stage and on the radio, you can always get Cross Currents delivered directly to your phone or computer. Subscribe on iTunes or at kalw.org/subscribe. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Luisa Cardoza, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Hey, hey! This music is by East Bay musician Liz DeRoche, who goes by her child nickname, The Singing Lizard. She plays from her new children's album at a dance party this Saturday afternoon at the Octopus Literary Salon in Oakland. This free show begins at 4 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. It's a magic place we can make believe. We can draw whatever we want. Sky upside down. So